the weekend can be a break from the daily grind at work or whatever you've got going on. It's a chance to refresh, reflect. I'm Lizzie O'Leary, and this is Marketplace Weekend, where the economy meets real life. And this week on the show, we are reflecting as well, with a collection of several of our favorite stories and interviews, from musicians who are upending the traditional model of money-making in the music business, to a director who's taking on sexism in Hollywood. We've also got stories about the strange institution that is the American office, why smart people do really dumb stuff at work, and why, yes, some bosses are just total jerks. So relax and indulge in some great stories throughout the hour, and come tell us what you think of them at Marketplace.org, on Marketplace's Facebook page, or on Twitter. We're at Marketplace WKND. We're starting today with an interview I love, with two people who are redefining success in the music business. Run the Jewels is the hip-hop duo formed by rapper-producer Jamie Maleen, better known by his stage name, LP, and Michael Render, better known as Killer Mike. They came together in their late 30s after they'd each had years of ups and downs in the music business, and they joined me to talk about friendship, success, and money. Killer Mike, LP, welcome to Marketplace Weekend.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Thank you.
So I'm just curious, what did you think when you heard a business show wanted to talk to you?
They got to have the wrong group.
Yeah, wrong number.
Why?
We're artists.
Yeah, we're artists. I mean, we do business, but we've said it before. We're not primarily a thinking operation. We just kind of do things that we want to do, and then we figure it out afterwards.
There's no grand master evil plan that we had set up that we knew we'd take over the world by giving an album for free. It just felt like the right thing to do as an artist and as former kids who just loved rap music in this new environment. It just felt right.
You just called yourself a former kid, and I'm curious, since you guys are...
I noticed that,
yeah,
too.
Well, so you guys are about my age. You both had success when you were younger, and then you wrestled with not having it. I'm curious how you think about money now and whether that's changed.
Interesting. Interesting thought. You know, I think that, at least for me, I would say that that's sort of the way it was, but not really. I mean, you have to think, we've actually been having our careers this entire time. It's not like we went and worked at, UPS. I think of money the same way that everyone thinks of money. I like to be as free as possible in this world. And if the game is that you have to collect a bunch of green pieces of paper in order to be able to be autonomous and not have to deal with people you don't want to deal with, I'm going to go get that. I love making money. But I just think at this point, both Mike and I agree that we're not going to do it unless we feel right about it, or unless the surrounding, circumstances are that we're happy. You know,
Mike, what about you?
I used to think money made me happy. And then I got a lot of it and I lost a lot of it and I was still happy. So I realized that it wasn't money that was making me happy. I was already happy. Money is a tool to be used, and it's used to take care of my wife and children. It's used to invest in my retirement. It's used for me to open and run business. And I'm glad that I've mastered some aspects of using that tool and what isn't, and I'm not being foolish or wasteful like I was when I was younger.
Yeah. Ooh, boy.
Yeah, you think about the money you went through.
So let's just take a moment let's take a moment of silent reverence for the money blown in our 20s.
Yeah.
What did you blow it on?
Me? Drugs, strippers, whatever I wanted. I wasn't a man of deep vision.
Yeah, when you're 20 years old, you wasted on what all 20 years old. Everything you think you want, everything from stuff you order online. I'm from Atlanta, the capital of the strip club, so I put a considerable amount of women through college, I'm sure.
An apartment that's too expensive.
That aren't worth the next year what you pay for. You know, just all the stupid stuff. You know, when you grow up working class or poor, you have a fantasy of buying stuff. And when you first get money, you indulge that fantasy and you can overindulge.
Right. Because you can't actually see anything bigger there's no bigger picture. You know, it's like, wait a second. Last week I had no money and now I have $5,000.
I needed this pink fur coat.
I'd probably be fine with $1,000. Let's just take that $4,000 and make a couple memories, fellas.
Well, wait a minute. I want to ask you guys, though, about the business now, because you've both been in the business for a while, and artists get compensated very differently now than, when you were in your 20s. So where does the revenue come from? Where are you making money from? You put your music on the internet for free.
We do. And we also put it on iTunes, and we also put it on every streaming service, which we have direct dealings with because we're not signed to the major labels.
And we tour very hard.
And we tour very hard.
250 days a year.
We've sold almost 100,000 copies of our album.
We sell a lot of t-shirts.
Physical. And t-shirts and, you know, and that's with giving the record away for free. The idea for giving the record away for free was an acknowledgement of the reality of the industry and also a strategic manipulation of it, you know. We make money off of everything. Record sales. We make money off of streaming.
Merchandise.
Merchandise is huge. We make money off of shows. It's huge. We make money off of licensing. We make money off of, you know, we've turned this into a real, you know, job for us that is lucrative, by literally letting go of some of the old sort of fashioned ideas of what the industry is. I think it was really just a recognition of the fact that all bets are off to a degree, and goodwill and connection with the people who would be supporting you is the most important currency to have, because at the very least, they're going to allow us to do this thing that we love, and that's what drives our lives. You know.
Let me ask you guys. You know, Mike, you're black. Elle, you're white. You grew
what?
Up being
what?
In love with hip hop.
What's going on here?
Being in love with hip hop as a teenager. I'm curious, what kind of conversations about race you guys have together?
Huh.
Honest ones.
Really honest ones. I mean, we're very close as friends, you know. Our friendship is so easy that there's and rooted in so many things, so many aspects of our personality and our history and the things that we love and the conversations we have. But it does come up. We're very aware that even us having a public friendship and even us having a chemistry and making music that works is a powerful thing to some degree for people to see, especially in times of confusion and you know, strain.
I think everyone should have a friend of a different class, culture, or race. I think you can view people like, oh, they're cool as groups of people and don't bother them. But if you don't have a Muslim friend, you know, you're not as progressive as you think. If you're black, you don't have a white friend. If you're white, you don't have a black friend or an Asian friend. If you don't have
if you're straight, you don't have a gay friend.
Yeah. If you don't have someone from outside of your social circle of comfort, then you could be doing more. And that's just that simple. I encourage my children. They have different friends. I encourage adults, young people, because I think that actual growth comes out of human experiences with people versus looking at data or being a voyeur on the news saying, well, those people are good or bad. Either way, you're still a voyeur and you're out of that world. You should put yourself in the world of someone else so that your world grows.
I want to change tack slightly. My colleague Kai Rizdal does this thing where he asks people to describe their jobs in 5 words. What would you say your jobs are?
I don't work at all.
Trying to find sleep time.
Those are pretty good.
Giggling high with Killer Mike.
Making mad dough with LP. Rocking shows, spitting flows, gone.
Ooh, I think we have to end it there.
Respect.
Killer Mike, LP, thank you guys very much.
Our pleasure.
Love and respect. Thank you for having us.
Thanks for having us, guys.
We're going to stay with music now and play a swan song for an artifact of my youth. Not too long ago, compact disc mail order giant Columbia House shut down, taking a penny-sized chunk of our hearts with it. Soraya N. McDonald of ESPN's The Undefeated has this tribute.
When I read that Columbia House filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy protection, my first reaction was, they were still around? Columbia House was responsible for me cultivating my own musical tastes outside of my parents. The first cultural artifact I could truly claim as my own came as a gift to me from my older and only sister, Carol. It was the debut cassette of hip-hop New Jack swing group called Another Bad Creation. When Coolin' at the Playground, you know, came out in 1991, our father saw Red, Chris, Mark, Roro, and David in their oversized puffy coats and blanched. To him, they registered as menaces. Carol tried to explain that hip-hop was part of Black culture. My father growled back, "Not my culture." From that point on, it was clear that my appreciation and understanding for pop culture, especially hip-hop culture, lay largely in Carol's hands. It was she who had always ordered the musical contraband that barely registered as original compositions to our parents. We were a Charlie Parker and Tchaikovsky household. But once I became aware of another existence, I spent a lot of time recording Coolio and Mariah Carey off my see-through radio. The straight-A, goody-two-shoes expectations of my parents were hard to shake, though. I was a giant theater geek, so the first time Carol approached me and told me to pick a CD from the Columbia House order form, I chose Barbra Streisand's Back to Broadway. It was such a treat, and she'd allowed me a CD all my own, and I got to choose without any judgment from our parents. As I grew older and my tastes matured, I knew that when Carol asked me what I wanted for my birthday, I could count on her to come through with some Mary J. Blige. She gave me My Life and Share My World, which basically served as the melodramatic soundtrack for my high school years, played proudly on a hand-me-down stereo that came from who else? Carol. Now that we're both adults with busy lives, we still converge over our musical tastes. More than anything, we are unapologetic and slightly unhinged Mariah Carey stans. And I am still waiting for pop music's glitteriest grand diva to breeze through DC again, so I can pay back Carol for all of the oral lifelines she gave me as a nerdy kid growing up in small town North Carolina, courtesy of Columbia House.
Offices are weird and fascinating places. They have their own codes of behavior and, of course, their own cast of characters. Enter the awful boss. Marketplace's Sabri Benishore investigated this phenomenon, and it's one of our favorite stories ever. Welcome, Sabri.
Thanks.
You did an incredible story about a workplace archetype that I think most people are relatively familiar with. I'll put it in a sanitized version, the jerk boss.
Yep. That is, I wanted to look into why are so many bosses jerks? I mean, it can't just be our imagination. And that's how I started off, by asking people. And you know what? As I assumed, I heard a lot of jerk boss stories.
She would definitely get upset and yell and scream.
Texted people 2 o'clock in the morning, 3 o'clock in the morning, 4 o'clock in the morning.
And put me and my colleagues down.
And if you didn't respond within half an hour, you would be given a warning.
I mean, yes, I don't consider him a good person.
Most of these people didn't want to be identified because their bosses are jerks, among other reasons. Now, this jerk boss problem is not some kind of accident. At least a lot of researchers don't think so. It may not come as a total surprise, but there's a lot of research that suggests being a jerk can actually help you become a boss. Not a good boss, but a boss.
If you look at these traits, such as being Machiavellian, narcissistic, you will find that most of these traits tend to have short-term advantages.
Dr. Tomas Chamorro-Primusic is CEO of Hogan Assessments. It's a consulting firm that helps companies develop talent.
Some of these attributes help people get to a position of power and navigate their careers upwards, but at the same time, they don't really contribute to leadership effectiveness or management effectiveness, which is why you find so many bosses that are assholes.
It's not that hard to understand how this works. Take narcissists, people who are super egocentric and usually insecure at the same time.
Let's just take a door-to-door salesperson.
Murray Barrick is head of the Center for Human Resource Management at Texas A&M.
You know, door-to-door salespeople get rejected all the time, but a narcissistic door-to-door salesperson actually can handle that rejection much better, because a narcissistic salesperson would say, you're not rejecting me because of me, you're rejecting me because you're dumb or something.
Same thing for entrepreneurs and corporate leaders. Being narcissistic, or in some cases a sociopath, can be helpful in interviews too.
When you first meet a narcissist, they tend to make a positive impression on you.
Emily Grijalva is assistant professor at the University at Buffalo School of Management. She did a meta-analysis of 18 studies with 30,000 test subjects and found narcissism increases your chances of becoming a leader.
So if you were to meet someone narcissistic at a party, you'd probably think they were really entertaining and attractive.
She says narcissists tend to be better dressed, have better posture, and be charming. Some sociopaths can do this too.
They're going to portray themselves as being a leader.
These people believe that they're good.
Jeannie Brantover is a managing partner at Boyden Global Executive Search. She described her former boss earlier. She says confidence does not equal competence.
These people aren't, they're not really imposters, you know. When I interview people, they really believe in themselves, you know, whether someone is, you know, an egomaniac, just not a good person. You know, they truly have bought into whoever they are.
Now, here's where it's not totally the narcissist or the sociopath or the jerk's fault. Part of the problem, many researchers argue, is that we think wrongly that jerks make good leaders. So even if we have an inkling that someone is a boorish, maniacal brute, we're somehow drawn in.
Showing that kind of asshole behavior matches up to this bad idea that is embraced in the business world that the most effective leader is the hard-nosed driver.
Fred Keel is the author of The Return on Character and founder of KRW International. They help develop leadership inside companies.
So they're a little rough on people. At least they're taking action.
Tomas Jamoro-Premusic says that because of this jerk effect, bosses are actually more likely to fail.
There's a lot of data on this. In general, bosses perform pretty poorly. If you look at large corporations in the past 5 years, on average, they have all fired around 15 to 20% of senior leaders, so C-suites, you know, CEO, COO, and so forth.
The sad thing about jerk bosses, and this is actually one of the things that can do them in the end, is that they don't really take cues or criticism. In fact, if you are a jerk, narcissistic boss listening to this story, you're probably going to think it's about your boss, when actually, it's about you.
I listened to this story with a little bit of dread, but also a lot of recognition, Sabri. What did you hear from people after this ran?
Oh, my God. It was like such an outpouring. Like, this was spot on. Like, oh, my God. Did you talk to my boss for this story? This makes total sense. And you know what? It does. And it, in my opinion, it boils down just so well to that little phrase that one of my interviews used. Confidence does not equal competence. You know, that's what it comes down to. But we love confidence. We love it. And we put so much faith in it that we select these people.
Marketplace's Sabri Benishore, thank you.
You're welcome.
To stay in the world of work now. Have you ever had a moment at your office, or many moments, when maybe you finished a project and learned, oh, someone else was working on something totally similar? Or perhaps you find out that managers just weren't communicating with one another. That sort of thing is at the heart of Gillian Tett's book, The Silo Effect. People wall themselves off, overspecialize, and it results in great big messes. Tett is the U.S. managing editor for the Financial Times, and she visited our studio in New York to talk about the book. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me on.
I want to start with this moment in 2008 where Queen Elizabeth is at the London School of Economics.
You don't often get queens going to talk to economists, but hey.
And you have this great description of her saying in her clipped upper-class vowels, "It's awful. Why did no one see the crisis coming?" This story, to me, crystallizes a lot of what is happening in your book.
You're absolutely right. And the essence of my book is to look at a seemingly very simple question, which is, Why do so many smart people in our world keep doing things that look incredibly dumb? And back in 2008, when the Queen went to London School of Economics, everyone was asking themselves, well, we have these brilliant economists. Some of the best economists in the world are at the LSE, the Bank of England, the Federal Reserve. And yet somehow they were all shocked by the credit crisis and they were completely at a loss about what to do afterwards. So she was trying to figure out why were they blind. And at the time, many people thought it was because somehow the bankers had fooled the economists. They had concocted a plot to hide what was going on. And what I argue is actually there's a much simpler explanation, and that is tunnel vision. Extreme tunnel vision and tribalism, if you like. You have a group of very highly paid, very highly respected economists and other policymakers who were so blinded by their own definition of what they should be looking at, and it was a very narrow vision, that they completely missed the real story.
You know, a lot of this stuff is pretty familiar to anyone who works in an office who gets to the end of some project and is like, well, wait a minute, I didn't know that Bob was assigned to this too. Is there some human reason we do this?
The simple human reason why we create these mental boxes, these borders, is because as a human species, we are completely overwhelmed all the time by data, by people, by processes, by ideas, by things. And we have to sort them out to create order. I mean, just think about your own house. If you didn't have a system to sort out, say, your cutlery or your clothes, it would be chaos. And it's the same thing in our culture and our lives. The problem comes when those boxes become so rigid and so competitive that they breed tunnel vision. Or else when a society creates a sense of order and structure which was well suited to the world as it existed, say, a century ago, but hasn't moved on as the world around it changes.
So how do you spot them, and then how do you fix them? Second question probably being harder.
Well, there are all kinds of management techniques you can use to try and break down silos in a company. And I tell the story of, say, Facebook as one example of this. And what they've essentially done is to say, yes, we need dedicated specialist teams to write code, but we need to make sure those coding teams don't become rival tribes that all go out and try and compete with each other and withhold information. So they deliberately switch people around between teams a lot. They take people out of their normal teams and make them collaborate with other people, say, once a month. They create a lot of social ties and networks that cut across the teams. So there's lots of techniques you can use.
I mean, some of this sounds kind of hammy.
It sounds very hammy, but I would argue the most important thing of all about trying to master silos is actually to use what sits between your ears, i.e. your brain. And to start off noticing that the way we classify the world, which most of us frankly never think about at all, is quite fundamental to how we think and live and act. And yet, here's a key point. There's more than one way to classify the world. You don't have to be locked into the system or the cultural assumptions that you absorbed from your environment. We don't have to be blind creatures of our own environment, because you can look at your boundaries and borders and say, well, this one works, but this one doesn't. Or let's look at what lies outside our boxes and doesn't quite fit into our neat classification system for the world. Because often the things that fall between the cracks or sit just outside our mental boundaries are not only the most dangerous things, in that can be where risks lie, but it can also be the most interesting things if you're looking to be innovative and creative.
In that vein, what have you learned about yourself writing this?
I've realized that I tend to naturally create the kind of teams that I inherit. Journalists very easily create departments that were great for covering the world that existed, say, 10 years ago. But it's very hard to change those teams as the world and the story changes, because then you start to threaten power structures. So I'll take a small example. How do we cover fintech, the blend that's going on between the internet, digital companies, and finance? It's a big question, because it's a hot issue right now in financial reporting. And the reality is that, you know, we've traditionally had a financial services team who write about banks. We have an economics team who write about money. And then we have a technology team who write about all those whizzy gadgets. But these days, the story cuts across boundaries. We're lucky enough on the FT to have a fairly fluid structure. But even so, having to rethink constantly how you organize yourself is absolutely critical. And to my mind, the definition of great journalism is when you really do start to jump across boundaries and silo bust and make people look at the world afresh and not just in their familiar patterns.
Gillian Tett, columnist and U.S. managing editor at the Financial Times, thank you.
Thank you.
Now we're going to go on a high-tech treasure hunt with an expert in geocaching. Basically, it's hide-and-seek to find things with GPS when you and I interact with the world of tech. Ben Johnson is the host of Marketplace Tech and our guide to tech in real life. Hi, Ben.
Hello, Lizzie.
Where are we?
We are near the bottom of Manhattan. We're on an adventure today. We're talking about geocaching.
Would you like to explain who we have with us?
Yeah, so we have somebody who's much more of an expert than me. I've seen geocaching on at least one Real Housewives show and have talked to a couple of people about this, but I've actually never done it. And we are standing with what some people describe as the king of geocaching in New York. I don't know if he would describe himself that way.
You're shaking your head, man.
But his name is Brett Rogers. Hey, Brett.
Hi, how you doing?
Good.
So right now we're in the middle of a puzzle cache. We've solved the first stage, so we knew where to go next.
And we came from the Trinity Graveyard.
We learned some interesting things about colonial history, and we watched some gravestones, and we broke some code. And now we are nearing the finish line of where hopefully there will be a geocache waiting for us.
And this happens in steps, right?
Yeah, you start at the website. You go to geocaching.com. There's listings for all sorts of geocaches listed all around the city, all around the world. Some of them are very straightforward. Some of them say, go to these coordinates and look around, and here's a hint. Others have a lot more complicated steps involved. Others might say, here's a puzzle you have to solve to figure out the first part of the coordinates, or you need to solve this series of clues before we'll tell you where to go next. This is one that involved a little bit more puzzle solving, so this is the kind of geocache that I tend to gravitate towards more.
Why did you get into doing this?
Well, so I was introduced by my brother, Kevin, who's a real outdoorsman, and he has always had GPS receivers for actual work and things that are, you know, useful.
GPS started as a military technology.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So the technology existed, and it was opened up for civilian use, but it was intentionally scrambled because the military, understandably, has some concerns about people using their technology against them. But in May of 2000, President Clinton decided to descramble much of the signal, and overnight, everyone's receivers went from being good to within about 300 feet to being good to about 30. So now you had a situation where all of a sudden people had toys that were 10 times better than they were before, and it was, what are we going to do with these? And so someone had an idea to hide something in the woods and post some coordinates and leave some interesting things inside and post them to the internet and say, hey, I did this. Why don't you come follow my footsteps and solve the clues and find the treasure? And that's kind of where it started.
I'm totally into the sort of national treasure aspect of this. After looking at the Masonic symbols in the graveyard,
yeah, absolutely.
I'm down.
I think the very idea that there's something that's sort of hidden in a city that has, you know, 8 million people in it, and you know a little bit about it, and not everyone else does, and there's clues you have to follow. It's like when you see movies like The Goonies, and you just think to yourself, I want that to be my life. And certainly when you're 12 and you're watching that movie, you really want it to be your life. And I think a lot of us just kind of still have a little piece of that left.
Sure.
And this is a way to kind of tap into that a little bit. You know, if you can give yourself a little bit of a cinematic experience, I think it makes for a much more exciting week. So.
Nick Cage won't be at every single geocaching adventure, but we can at least, his spirit is here.
What were the instructions that would have brought us here?
First, we found James Leeson headstone in the Trinity Graveyard, which had a Masonic code on top of it, which had puzzled people in real-life New York for a long time, but now we know what it says, and it says, remember death. We used that information to sort of plug back in some information that was on the cache page and some other coded letters, which, when we combined all that information, it said to go to a small park, Greenwich and Edgar, and look at the bench in the northwest corner.
And that guy just got up. Can we go over and look at it?
The bench is now free.
Can we go over there and see what's there?
Okay.
All right.
We're going to freak this lady out.
All right. So do you think... Oh, man. So this does feel northwest. We're in the northwest corner. We're at the edge of the bench. Lizzie, should one of us start reaching under there and see if...
Is that what we're supposed to do?
I don't know. We're so lucky to be with the guy who designed this, so
you
I don't
do
have
it,
to
man.
Put my hand into some gum. Okay, I'm going to go down. I'm going to go down on the ground here. Oh, this is awkward. There's nothing under here.
Maybe go to your right, buddy.
Oh, I think I see something. Hold on. Okay, so it's like coffin-shaped, this thing. I'm pulling out a tag. Okay.
Oh! All right, so we got this little tag, and it says, Geocaching, congratulations, you found it, intentionally or not. This is a playing piece for a worldwide game dedicated to GPS users called geocaching.
Wow. This is cool.
Ah, there's some other stuff in here. If you found this container by accident, you're welcome to join us. Just put it back, basically. And what's that little guy?
That is a Path Tag calling card that someone has left behind. And this is a logbook.
Oh, it's a logbook. So just like on the top of a mountain or something.
We can log our... Look at all those people who've logged in their visits.
Oh, there's a lot of people in here. What do you say, Lizzie?
Yeah.
I mean, we sort of cheated, but I think we should still sign it, don't you?
Yeah, I think you should...
I think the rest of our summer has been plotted out for us. What do you think, Lizzie?
I agree.
All right.
Brett Rogers, Ben Johnson, thank you very much.
Yeah, this was a fun adventure.
Yeah, thanks. It was fun.
In today's show, we're looking back on some of our standout stories. For years, directors, actresses, and executives have been speaking out about sexism in Hollywood. And our entertainment correspondent Adrienne Hill sat down with a powerful director back in October to talk about women in the industry and her most recent movie. Hi, Adrienne.
Hey, Lizzie.
You're our guide to the entertainment industry, and you spent some time watching a new movie, talking to the director. Tell me about it.
I got to take an early look at a film called Miss You Already. It's basically a love story between two women best friends. It stars Toni Collette, Drew Barrymore, and it's directed by a woman named Catherine Hardwicke. You might know her from 13 or Twilight. I actually headed over to Catherine's house and office in Venice to talk with her some about it, and she told me it would have been really tough to get this movie made here in Los Angeles.
We didn't make it in this town. We made it in London with British money. You know, it's just very difficult to, as we know what the odds are. We've been, you know, talking about them a lot, how few movies written by a woman get made, how few movies directed by a woman fewer get made, and how few starring two women over 35 get made. So, you know, it has all the odds against it, plus a difficult subject. It's not like a broad comedy or something.
She's talking about gender there. There's a huge focus on gender in Hollywood right now. You guys got into a long conversation about that. Tell me about it.
Yeah, so, I mean, just to give some background numbers here, in 2014, last year, women only directed 7% of the top 250 grossing films. So directors, female directors seem very underrepresented when you're talking about these big budget movies. But before I get into the conversation I had with her, I have to sort of start with a digression. It's been incredibly hot in Los Angeles. So we're at her house. The coolest room in her house is her bedroom. So I wind up doing this interview on her bed that turns out to be a very famous bed. This is the bed, Lizzie, where Kristen Stewart and Robert Pattinson auditioned. The stars from 13 met here. So we're on this bed. I was sitting on this little piece of movie history. It's kind of amazing. But to get back to our conversation about gender. So we're sitting, we're talking, and she tells me that for years in her career, she thought she was struggling because she just wasn't working hard enough, because she didn't have the break. So then she directs Twilight, which made almost $400 million worldwide. She was in the Guinness Book of World Record for the biggest opening weekend by a woman director. And she thought that would open all these doors for her.
You know, I would try to get interviews on other films, and they would literally tell my agent, oh, we want to hire a man for that job.
Wow.
Even though the men that they hired, that you could add up all of their movies, didn't even make as much as one of my movie. So it wasn't about money. It wasn't about, you know, skill or awards or this or that. It was, I started to understand the gender bias.
What did it feel like to realize this bias was real after Twilight came out and then you weren't getting those jobs?
how can anybody work harder than me? You think, you know, pity party, like I did so much preparation and I've worked for so many guy directors. They just walked out on set. They didn't even know what they were shooting. You know, it's frustrating, but you know, of course we all think let's take the negative and turn it into a positive. This year, this could change. We could stop having this conversation and have much more interesting and diverse films too.
Do you feel like being a woman has affected your bottom line and your career as a director?
Oh, yeah. I mean, the statistics are irrefutable. How can you say no? Look at the amount of movies that men have directed and how much they've made, and look what women have directed and what they've made. You can't even have a brain and dispute the facts. You know, there's no intelligent way to say that women aren't affected by this kind of bias. That's why I think it's great that ACLU took it up.
And what about your agents and representation? What do they say about all of this? Have they ever said, hey, don't speak up as much?
Truthfully, in the past, in the PR field, at agencies and different things say, you know, you've got to be careful on the code word woman issues, like female issues, like being emotional on set and things like that, you know. So those things definitely have come up. Here's another example of a gender bias. My boyfriend made a micro-budget movie, and he found a sales agent to go out and sell the movie. And she said, my boyfriend's name is Jamie. She said, listen, if we could put James, which is not his name, as directed by James, then we would have a much better chance of selling it, because if it says Jamie, there's a 50-50 chance the director could be a woman, and that's going to hurt sales.
What year was that?
This year. Yeah.
What did Jamie do?
What did he do? Oh, well, that's not his name. James is not his name, so he just left his name on it, you know. But, I mean, just the idea that there's a 50-50 chance it could be directed by a woman, well, that's going to be a detriment to selling the film. That's pretty bad. You know, we have these incredible situations that we're facing in the world that we need to change. I mean, there's no question about it.
Catherine, thanks so much.
Yeah, thank you guys so much for having me. It's a great, important subject. I love it that you guys are covering this.
Adrian, Catherine Hardwick referenced the ACLU in your conversation with her there. Can you explain that a little bit?
Absolutely. So the ACLU has for a while now been interviewing women directors. I think they've now done 80 interviews with directors in the city, talking about their experiences trying to get work. They, in May, called on the EEOC and other government agencies to really investigate. They're calling it a civil rights violation. And their reports now, the EEOC is following up. It's setting interviews with many women directors. It's actually jumping into this. So it's a very interesting time. We don't know much about this investigation, but we do know that more and more people are taking it seriously.
And do you get the sense from Catherine Hardwick that she thinks things are going to change?
I think she's optimistic. I think that there's a sense this has been happening for a really long time. And right now, because of the efforts by the ACLU, because more and more women directors are standing up and saying, wait, I feel like I've been discriminated against, people are starting to pay attention. So I would say she's optimistic that things could change.
Marketplace's Adrian Hill. Thanks a lot.
Thanks.
You're listening to Marketplace Weekend. Televised police chases have become something of a staple in TV news, despite the fact that they can have terrible consequences. We wanted to figure out why these things are such a draw and such a lucrative one for television. So we turned to Al Tompkins, who's worked in TV news for 40 years and now teaches journalism at the Poynter Institute. Hi, Al.
Hi.
How did this become a thing, a part of our sort of colloquial understanding of what goes on TV news?
In 1998 and 1999, there were some pretty horrific incidences that happen in California. In 98 in Los Angeles, there was a man who took his own life on TV. Then in San Diego in 99, there was a person who died in a chase that ended in a shootout. And in both cases, television said, you know what, we ought to rethink this. We ought to rethink about whether we air these things live. And then they just kept on doing it because they were, you know, they were ratings magnets. First of all, we had helicopter technology and microwave technology that allowed them to go live. The pictures from the television cameras were amazing because there was an image stabilization camera that allowed you to zoom in from far away in ways that you couldn't do if it was a shoulder-held camera. So lots of things happened. There was opportunity, there was transmission, there was the visual, and by the way, a huge amount of airtime to fill on cable that right. couldn't always be filled with actual news. So all of these things sort of made a witch's brew of opportunity, and this was just one thing that was born of it.
Do we know how much it costs a station to put one of these things on the air?
Well, it's expensive. There's no doubt about it. But journalism often is expensive. The cost of putting a helicopter up is in the hundreds of dollars per half hour. But that's just the beginning of the cost. You also have the cost of the pilot, the cost of the airtime. If you're interrupting commercials, that's right. money.
What's the return to a station for televising one of these?
Well, there are a couple of returns. One, the short term, obviously, is probably the overnight ratings. Another might be to build your reputation that whatever's going on, we're there, we're on top of it. We can bring it to you live. And we have to also acknowledge that there is also this public service that could come if you're covering something that's truly newsworthy. Now, if all you're doing is taking in a feed from another city and it doesn't affect people, then I think there's an actual cost, not necessarily a benefit. A cost to your reputation that you're just sort of there as a vulture and you'll air anything that's graphic that ends, you know, in bloodshed.
But theoretically, there's also a financial return, right, if viewers flock to these things?
Ratings equal money. There's no doubt about that. That if you can consistently generate ratings, then advertisers are more interested in advertising with you, in theory, because you'll reach more people. But an individual event isn't very saleable. That is to say, nobody's going to say, look, if you happen to have a car chase and that car is going to end up in a crash, I am a used car dealer and maybe people will be interested in that. Or maybe what they'll want is a faster car. So I sell fast cars and I'll advertise on you. Just make sure you stick me in there somewhere if there's another car chase. Nobody does that. So it's not an instant payoff. What you're doing is reputation building. For better or worse, you're reputation building when you cover these things.
So talk me through making this decision. You're in a newsroom. You know this thing is happening. You don't have long to react.
You don't have long to react, which is why you ought to practice. You ought to think about this prior to it happening. Once you've decided to go there, it seems to me you have to ask a series of questions of yourself. One, is this so important that you're willing to air the worst possible outcome? Because if the answer to that is no, you better have another plan, whether that plan is a delay, which is possible, totally possible. It's totally possible to have a live signal come back to a television station and put it on a tape delay, whether it's 5 seconds, 10 seconds, or 30 seconds. It's totally possible. And yet station after station, network after network doesn't do it. So it's just one of those mystifying things. Why don't they do it? Well, it's cumbersome. It's troublesome. It probably is going to be okay. We'll have a quick finger. We won't get caught. This doesn't look like that kind of thing. Well, you know what? You just never know.
So if you look forward, station stream on the internet, there are so many different journalistic outlets. Is this going to change at all, do you think?
Well, I would have thought 10 years ago or 15 or 20 years ago, the answer would have been yes. But here we are. All these years later, almost 20 years after the first noteworthy one, and no, nothing much has changed at all.
Al Tompkins is a senior faculty member at the Poynter Institute. Thank you so much for talking with us.
You're sure welcome.
We're ending today with an interview that sort of called out my questionable observation skills. I live in New York. Brooklyn, to be specific, and that means I take the subway and spend a lot of time reading on it. So I read Sarah Vowell's book, Lafayette and the Somewhat United States, on the train. It's about the Marquis de Lafayette and his tremendous influence in the founding of our country, And honestly, it took me reading the book on my commute to work to notice that Lafayette Avenue, where I get on the subway every day, is named for the guy. But Lafayette is everywhere in America. And Val and I talked about that and the influence that this aristocratic teenage Frenchman had when he worked for free for a group of rebellious tax protesters, a.k.a. our founding fathers.
I was living on Union Square for about 10 years in New York, and there's a little statue of him there, and I walked by it just about every day because it's next to the sidewalk, and he was kind of one of my neighbors, you know.
Obviously, we're Marketplace, so I'm going to focus on the money part of this, but money and class are
very... Do you want to do the numbers?
I do not want to do the numbers because that would... I think everyone's heard the numbers.
I wouldn't want to be doing the numbers like during the French Revolution, you know.
Yeah, they would. Well, also, you know, they don't work out that well for him. He does have to run away.
No, that's
but
true.
But how did a really rich young Frenchman end up, as you put it, working for free for a bunch of, you know, anti-tax protesters?
When Lafayette decided to take off from France and throw in with these penniless rebels across the sea, he was 19 years old. So, like a lot of 19-year-olds, I don't know if he had entirely thought it through. The one thing was he came from this military family. Lafayette wanted to follow in his father's footsteps and achieve battlefield glory, and you kind of need battles for that. France wasn't at war yet, so part of it was just he wanted to be a soldier.
Well, this thing that struck me when I was reading this was your research in 2013, and you're going to national parks that are potentially going to be shut down because the government shut down, the election in 1824. And then there's this passage where you say, you know, Franklin's talking about wondering if negotiations would collapse. And you say, that is, to me, the quintessential experience of living in the United States, constantly worrying whether or not the country is about to fall apart. Now, we live in this moment of thinking that that experience is new, but all throughout your book, you're giving us examples that is, in fact, not at all new, and maybe the thing about what it means to be American?
Totally. I mean, it's our birthright. I mean, I'm speaking to you from Philadelphia, and, you know, the first thing that happens in the Continental Congress, the first thing a guy says, let's open with a prayer. Second thing two guys say, no way, we're Episcopalians and you're Baptists and Quakers and Congregationalists and we can't pray together. All they did in the Continental Congress and later in the Constitutional Convention was argue with each other. I mean, they eventually come to sort of compromises, and I don't think they get enough credit for that, maybe. I mean, it's why the title of the book calls it the somewhat United States. And I don't mean that completely disparagingly. I mean, while I was working on this, I came to see argument as sort of the through line in our national park, but not necessarily as a failing. And it comes from this republic they established back then. I mean, it was pretty ironic to have to, you know, postpone my trip to Independence Hall to celebrate the inventions at Independence Hall, because Independence Hall was shut down and the lights were turned off because the government invented at Independence Hall was set up to have this separation of powers that led to the government shutting down, you know. But in talking about all the places in this country named after Lafayette, I mean, I end at Lafayette Square across from the White House.
Yeah.
And I say that's the most meaningful place named after him, because it's where we protest, and we should not take our bickering and rancor and loathing of one another for granted, because we have that right. We have that right to bicker. We have the right to get on each other's nerves.
Sarah Vowell, author of Lafayette and the Somewhat United States, thank you.
Oh, sure.
And that's our show for this week. Want to join the conversation? Visit our website, marketplace.org, chat with us on Marketplace's Facebook page, or call us 1-800-648-5114. Marketplace Weekend is produced by Eliza Mills and Raghu Manavalan, with contributions this week from Jenny Ament. Dan Semitovich is our senior producer, and Ben Tolliday is our engineer. Our theme music is composed by Nara Rao. Deborah Clark is Marketplace's executive producer and vice president. I'm Lizzie O'Leary. Thanks for listening. This is APM.